Before this with It Gets Better, the Chris Stussy remix. And that's about it for me for today. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. If you want to get in touch with me, or if you missed a show, check out my website at djfirefly.com. And also, I'll be at New Amsterdam on November 1st.
Lee Reynolds, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear from our own Michael Smith, who moderated the Orr Books event launching From the Flag to the Cross. Speakers included economist Rick Wolf, New York-based writer Margaret Kimberly, and economist Kashama Sawant. We then look at the state of pretrial detention in New York City jails, where 7,000 people are held, not for crimes, but because they cannot afford bail or have been remanded to custody. Gazeller Marocain, executive director of the Pretrial Justice Institute, joins us to talk about why people are being detained before they're found guilty. And we talk about the pathways to reform. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style, is the title of a newly published book, edited by Zachary Sklar and our own Michael Smith. The book draws from seven key interviews with prominent socialist thinkers in the United States and Canada. They include Margaret Kimberly, Henry Giroux, Diane Feely, and Bill Mullen. Last month, publishers Orr Books held a book launch event at Live on Avenue C in the East Village. Speakers included economist Rick Wolf, New York-based writer Margaret Kimberly, and economist Kashama Sawant, with Michael Smith moderating. Let's have a listen.
Kashama Sawant, what is fascism?
So, yeah, I appreciate Rick and Margaret already speaking to it. Just to add to some of the points, especially that Rick made, historical points, I think fascism, Michael started the question accurately, which is that we're not in fascism now, so we have to define fascism accurately. Fascism, as it historically developed, especially in countries like Italy, Germany, and Spain, was reigned by under the capitalist system to specifically engineered to brutally crush working class movements. And it is not, and Rick alluded to this, it is not, fascism is not the preferred mode of operation of the capitalist class. It is much easier and better for the capitalist class if they can organize their system of massive exploitation and oppression on the basis of people generally being okay with it and liberal ideas dominating and the capitalist class not having to use the kind of savage force that is needed for fascism to come into being. But they will do it if they need to. That's the point. And but also just to be clear why this today it's not fascism is also to understand that fascism, for the capitalist class to carry out fascism, they require a highly organized base that will support it and also help carrying it out. Right now those conditions don't exist, but the question is very appropriate at this moment because those conditions could sneak up on us if the left didn't get its act together. The failures of the parties, the left parties at that time, the Marxist parties, in actually pushing back against fascism. And I think that lesson should be taken seriously right now, even though Trump is not fascist in the sense that Trump doesn't have the kind of organized force that was needed to carry out fascism. The rise, one thing that's not disputable at all is the rise of right-wing and far-right ideas. That is absolutely happening, and that is deeply, deeply dangerous. And Trump wants to be totalitarian, of course, but he doesn't get to be just because he's a megalomaniac. Those, the material conditions have to exist, and those conditions don't exist yet, but they could come into being. And that's where I think the warning has to be. I agree with Margaret. You know, one of the points Margaret was talking about was ICE. I mean, these horrific ICE raids. They are not only targeted at the immigrant community, which itself is unspeakable, what is happening, and we all have to organize against it. But really, they're not even just that. They are really a pilot project, so to say, to see how far can the forces of the state go against the left, against working class movements. It's a trial method to see how far they can go in repressing people. But I think the elephant in the room in this discussion is the role of the Democratic Party and the Labour leadership as well, because Trump did not rise up in a vacuum. Trump left his first term, as the most unpopular president in modern U.S. history. How is it that this guy came back to power? This did not happen because somehow a mass of the working class is just irredeemably going towards the right. It's because the mass of the working class is angry at both parties, the Democrats and Republicans. So while Trump is carrying out his atrocities, which he absolutely is, and we should never make the mistake of underestimating how dangerous it is, but while that's happening, who are the most unpopular people in Washington, D.C.? It's the Democrats. The Republicans, but all of them are unpopular. The Republicans are extremely unpopular, but the Democrats, congressional Democrats, are even more extremely unpopular than the Republicans. So the story here is that the rise of the right wing, let alone fascism, is in no way inevitable. It is precisely because there is no force that is actually fighting for working class people. And if we had such a force on a mass scale, then we will be able to win over many people who are otherwise susceptible to Trump's agenda and right-wing ideologies. Many of them can be won over to an actual working class movement. And I'll just end on this point. At this moment, the majority of Americans are against the genocide in Gaza. And that includes... And that includes young people who identify as Republican voters. Only 24% of those who identify as Republican voters who are of the age of 18 through 35 are supporting the Israeli ethnic cleansing mission. So in other words, the question we have to ask is, how is it that even self-identified right-wing young people are against these horrific policies? If you look at the support for LGBTQ rights, the support for abortion rights, so many states that voted for Trump voted in bigger numbers for abortion rights ballot initiatives. So it's not only is it not true that the mass of the working class of the United States is just, you know, moving right and that's just going to happen? No, actually, the mass of the working class is angry at the billionaire class. They are angry at the parties of the billionaire class. And what is missing is an actual alternative to the Democrats and Republicans. And that's why I would say that our campaign, though it is, you know, in one district in Washington State, our campaign against genocidal Democrat Adam Smith is crucial as a national campaign. Because if we can win a revolutionary socialist office in U.S. Congress, that will be nothing short of a political earthquake, because that is the type of fight back that we need against the Democrats and Republicans.
Thank you, Shama. Thank you. My next question, how far along are we before fascism becomes irreversible? How do you appreciate Trump's bringing into line? That's the German phrase, Gestaltung, the Germans used it. Bringing into line the Supreme Court, the media, the big law firms, the universities. And what do you think of his using the National Guard in Washington, D.C., and his recent announcement that it should be illegal to criticize him, and his recent declaring that Antifa was a terrorist organization? How far along are we? Rick Wolf?
Well, we're on the path. I don't know how far along we are. I don't believe anything is irreversible, so I'm not going to give that to fascism either. Hitler thought it was irreversible, didn't turn out that way. Mussolini thought it was irreversible, didn't turn out, and on and on and on. So the burden is on those who think it's irreversible. I don't. I think Sharma's quite right. Much of this depends on how we function. We can't say that the majority of Americans don't agree with us, because it isn't true. Mostly they do. And between those who do and those who aren't sure but would listen to us, we are talking about a majority. The American left is extraordinary, and we have to face that. We are the victims of 75 years of unrelenting Cold War ideological indoctrination. Look at my white hair. I was born into it, and I've lived in it all my life. So have all of, most of you. I don't even know you. To think that that didn't settle in there somewhere, take root in your thinking, shape you in this novel, that song, this movie, whatever it was that got to you, would be naive. And one of the effects has been to teach multiple generations that there is something dangerous and untrustworthy in getting involved in a political organization, especially if it has anything that looks, smells, or sounds like socialism or communism. There is a deep feeling of that's not for me, or it's not safe, or I'm going to stay away from that, or I have other things to do. You know, in other cultures, and not that far from us, people are political. They talk about politics all the time because it's exciting, because it's what you do at the picnic. It's what you do with your friends at the bar. You talk about it. You argue about it. Americans don't want to talk about it. It's like a religion or sex or something else that's very private, very private. And that's why it's so hard to organize and mobilize on the left. That's why it's so sad to watch the organizations that get going then splinter into 47 groupuscules who spend more time, we all know it, right, who spend more time attacking one another than they do their common enemy. The real question again is Kishama's question. When will the left get its act together? Understand that it's much stronger than it imagines. The weakness of the left is a tactic of the right to keep us down. Don't believe it. We are numerically enormous. Who amongst us would have imagined a year ago that a Muslim socialist would run for mayor and win. I am among those who would have thought that's a long shot. I would have been wrong. I would have misunderstood the alienation of voters in New York from the two parties, as Kashama pointed out, who are looking for something new, something different. The people I know who voted for Mr. Trump voted for him not because of his tariff policy, which they didn't think about or care about. They voted for him because he was different. He said things that made it clear, oh, he's not a conventional politician. Opens his campaign by telling us that Mexicans are rapists. All right. We don't understand it. It makes no sense. But we know that a conventional Republican and Democrat knows, don't say that. He said it. He proved he was different. Now, Mr. Mamdani doesn't have to. It's just his name. It's enough. Those people aren't supposed to be in that situation. But they are. And he is different. And he makes no, doesn't hide it. And a majority of New Yorkers are voting for him. A majority of Jewish voters in New York are voting for him. This is remarkable in this city and is a suggestion that the left is strong but disorganized, and that the response to fascism getting any worse is get that left organized.
Thank you, Rick. Margaret Kimberly, how far along are we before fascism becomes irreversible?
Well, I'm going to agree with Rick. I don't think anything's irreversible, but we are very far along.
And couldn't pull it off in Chicago because there's a Democratic governor who said, no, we're not doing that. But he's going to states that are run by Republicans. So Memphis, Tennessee, majority black city, Democratic mayor. But the governor is a Republican and says, yes, we're going to do this. Now, there's no reason for this. However bad crime is in any particular location, crime rates are getting lower. But that's not the point. All these crime panics everywhere, here in New York, in Memphis, anywhere, they make black people the face of crime. And black people the face of those who need to be crushed. And one of the reasons the left is disorganized, lest we forget, is that the left was crushed in the early 70s. There was an active campaign to make sure we're not going to have this kind of activism again. The Powell memo, I think he was not yet a Supreme Court justice, telling the Chamber of Commerce or other people, listen, we can get rid of this. And so they did. And one of the ways that they did that was by crushing the black liberation movement. And so now we have, and he's not the first one. Lest we forget, Bill Clinton, during his campaign, having a photo op in front of black prisoners in Georgia, in the town where the Klan sprang up, Stone Mountain, Georgia. Even Barack Obama sometimes saying black fathers are irresponsible. It is it's a constant in American politics. And let me just say, we had fascism already. It was called Jim Crow segregation. That was fascism. So I feel like we're always on the edge in this country. But the thing that I'm most worried about now is warfare. Trump's, you know, crazy rambling speech. He does a 180 on Ukraine, saying, you know, Russia can be defeated. That's another feature of fascism, and that's warfare, military aggression. And we see that occasionally in U.S. history, but we now see Trump trying to start a war with Venezuela and Russia. They make sort of making up with China because they think they can split Russia from China. That's my belief. Gaza, Palestine, all of these things are what worry me. I worry about hot war. I worry about a hot war between nuclear-powered countries, and I worry about the ratcheting up of racist warfare is the biggest danger.
Yeah, I definitely agree with my fellow panelists that nothing is irreversible, but we are in dangerous times. I definitely agree about that, and I share Margaret's anxiety about hot wars. In fact, we already have hot wars, and we have, you know, a war that is devastating ordinary working class people in Ukraine and Russia. It's absolutely devastating. If you look at the numbers, it is unconscionable. And then, of course, you have the genocide in Gaza, but also not to forget that the genocide in Gaza is a means to the Israeli state's openly stated goal of ethnic cleansing. So, and that ethnic cleansing goal is being, the objective is being achieved through the genocide in Gaza, but also it's also going on, ethnic cleansing is also going on full swing in the West Bank. It is extremely dangerous and horrific. And if you look at the casualties, for example, the estimates from the scientific study from the Lancet show that probably 500,000 or more than 500,000 Palestinians have lost their lives. That is not to mention all the amputations that have happened. I mean, it is absolutely unspeakable what is happening. But I think all of this, again, that we will simply be unable to find any solution to make sure that this situation can be, today's situation can be reversed, unless we understand what is at the, you know, what are the forces that are driving all of this. And I think racism is an important question that we can examine. Jim Crow, for example, you know, Margaret mentioned Jim Crow. Jim Crow was a systematic policy that was carried out. Obviously, it was completely vicious against black working and poor people. But the reason it was carried out was precisely to prevent working class solidarity across race. And similarly, Fred Hampton and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. became very dangerous for U.S. capitalism the moment they started talking about class and not only, I mean, obviously racism is a real thing. And you cannot, as a Marxist, I don't believe that you can fight to overthrow capitalism unless that fight also includes an explicit fight against all forms of oppression, including racism. But what makes the left, what could make the left dangerous, what could make working class movements dangerous, is precisely when there is a strategy to unite those who might otherwise be on the other side, working class people who might be on the other side. And I think it's really important to examine the failures here and also the betrayals, I think, which is more a more apt word here, more appropriate word here. And it's not only the Democratic Party as a whole, it's the whole cabal of progressive Democrats, the so-called progressive Democrats. It is most of the labor leadership. It is most of the NGO leadership. It is tragic, but this is the situation. And unless we state the problem bluntly, there is no way we can find a solution. We have an obligation towards the Palestinian people, towards tens of millions of working class people in the U.S. to state the problem clearly, because otherwise we won't find the solution. And and I think we should talk about what happened with the BLM movement. You know, there was the rebellion in 2020, which brought out over 20 million people on the streets of the United States in multiracial working class solidarity against racism to make it the largest street protest movement in U.S. history. So I refuse to believe that we cannot win people, working class people over, like in masses, masses upon masses of people can be won over against racism and in a fight, in an explicit fight against racism. But what happened at the end of the day? That BLM movement has very little to show for itself in terms of victories, not because ordinary people failed, but because the leaders of the movement sold out. And so they were not BLM leaders, they were BLM misleaders. And we have to call that out. We cannot pussyfoot around it. Doing that, you know, stating that problem clearly will make you an enemy of the labor bureaucracy. It will make you an enemy of the NGO leadership. One other example I wanted to give in terms of how people are not irredeemable, working people are not irredeemable, is that one of the ways in which Trump won the election, one of the ways in which he tried to hoodwink ordinary people who ended up voting for him is the attacks on immigrants, you know, whipping up xenophobia, fomenting xenophobia. Yes, that is true. And anti-immigrant sentiments are a real thing, just like racism is a real thing. We cannot pretend it doesn't exist. However, we have to have a materialist approach to understanding how these consciousness evolves, and consciousness absolutely evolves. It is never a static phenomenon. Otherwise, we would not have come this far. We would not have won all the rights we have won for women and LGBTQ people and so on. So, you know, consciousness does evolve. But look at the real time in which it evolves. Even since the election last year, Trump has far little support for his anti-immigrant campaign than he did last year, because now that people are seeing the horrific manner in which it has unfolded, he has far less support for it. There is far more unity against the ICE raids, but what's missing is, again, the, you know, real forces that can do it. And so just one last thing I'll say, that you know, one thing that the Labour leadership could have done and has not done is organized, coordinated national strike actions, you know, one-day coordinated strike action. Shut down the profit machine and see how it puts pressure on the Trump administration, but they haven't done it.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Shana. We're going to have the next discussion, and it'll be the last discussion, but before we do that, I just want to say, from the flag to the cross, Fascism American Style, you can get it at orbooks.com. My last question, starting with Rick, is the ultimate question: what is to be done? Why is socialism the answer, Rick Wolf?
The basic reason socialism is the answer has to do with the world has changed in the last 25 years in ways that this culture that we all live in has systematically denied. It doesn't want to see what is happening. And it becomes crucial for us, as the first part of the answer, what is to be done, to face up to it. What do I mean? The dominance of the United States economically in the world is over. I'm trying to understand what's going on. Now, in part, we should have known and should have seen it. Our leaders should have known and should have seen it. The position of the United States at the end of World War II, 75 years ago, was weird in human history. All the other competitors we had, Britain, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, they were all wrecked. They were all destroyed. We weren't. After the bombs fell in Pearl Harbor, nothing happened here. No factory burned, no railroads went up in flame, nothing. The percentage of our people that went to war, much smaller than any of those other countries. Not only that, we discovered that the depression, which was really terrible, was overcome in the end by one thing, the war. The war took half the unemployed and put them in a uniform and the other half in a job making a uniform. And that was what ended the Great Depression. You know, you should have learned that lesson. You know why? Because over the last 3 years of the war in Iraq, a troubled Russian economy perked up. The war in Ukraine has strengthened the Russian economy, not weakened it. If you look at the statistics, the rate of growth of Russia in the last 3 years is significantly higher than the rate of growth of the United States. Now, if you didn't know that, welcome to the club. You didn't know, but you should have. The United States and its allies are something called the G7. They used to be the center of the world. G7, United States, Japan, Canada, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy. That's the G7. I added up the GDP, the gross output of those seven countries. That's what we economists do. We add things. I added it up. 28% of world output is accounted for by the G7. Just seven countries out of 190 countries produce 28%. Then I did the same thing for China and the BRICS. It's 35%. The United States is not the center of the world economy. They crossed the two lines in the year 2020, and the gap between them is getting wider. That's Mr. Trump's problem, and he can't solve it. The rest of what he does is the repressive effort to keep the lid on this disaster for which the American people were never prepared. That weird situation at the end of World War II, of course it couldn't last. Of course it created an American empire, which would eventually go down like every other empire the world has ever seen. It was never a question of whether, it was only a question of when. And I'm here to tell you, it's already going on. That's why we have this weird government. That's why we have the turn to fascism. They can't manage it. One of the things an empire going down does is to imagine it isn't. To have a theater that gets more extreme with America first, the more America is ninth. And as it becomes 10th and 11th, the intensity of the make-believe rises in direct proportion. The United States also, as a declining empire, is doing another thing that declining empires do. It's borrowing secretly from the empire that's rising, which is called, in case you haven't figured it out yet, China. And again, I'm not an advocate for China. China has lots of problems. That's another issue. I'm trying to get you to see the dilemma that the Trump fascist turn is facing. In 1970, the total debt of the United States was a few hundred billion dollars. Today, the debt of the United States is $37 trillion. That's a growth that dwarfs everything else. Prices didn't go up like that. Incomes didn't go up. Nothing did. This is a country living on debt. The United States, if you don't know, is the largest debtor country in the world. It has two major creditors in the world. Japan, number one. China, number two. Let me do that again. The biggest debtor in the world is the United States, and the second biggest creditor of the United States is the People's Republic of China. They own $750 billion worth of the debt of the United States. The world economy is leaving the United States behind. That's why the latest high tech is coming from China. The best electric cars and trucks in the world are made by the BYD Corporation. And if you never heard of it, it's because it's Chinese. We have 100% tariff in this country against those cars. That's why you don't know about them. But if you go to the rest of the world, they're everywhere. Why? Because they're the best car at the lowest price. You live in a country that won't let that happen.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. On any given day, roughly 7,000 people are held in New York City jails, mostly at Rikers Island, awaiting trial. Many are there not because they've been convicted of a crime, but because they can't afford bail or have been remanded to custody. Critics argue that New York's approach to pre-trial detention is both unjust and unsustainable, and that meaningful reform is long overdue. Detaining people before they've been found guilty turns the presumption of innocence upside down. This system hits Black and Latino New Yorkers the hardest. Lower average incomes and heavier policing in their neighborhoods make them far more likely to be jailed pre-trial. Beyond the human toll this takes, pre-trial detention drives up expenses for staffing, security, medical care, and administration, all paid by taxpayers. And the social costs ripple outward. Lockup before trial separates families, jeopardizes jobs, housing, and pressures individuals into pleading guilty simply to go home. Recently, the Pretrial Justice Institute joined forces with New York University's Center on Race, Inequality, and the Law and the Bronx Defenders to convene directly impacted people, public defenders, advocates, and service providers to reimagine a more just system. Their report, A City Without Cages, Creating Pretrial Safety and Liberty in New York City, outlines what that future could look like. Joining us to discuss it is Gisela Marroquin, Executive Director of the Pretrial Justice Initiative. Gisela, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having us.
Let's begin with a few definitions for our listeners. What exactly is pretrial detention, and how does it differ from alternatives to incarceration?
Absolutely. So pretrial detention refers to the period of time that someone spends in jail waiting to be in front of a judge, right? What is called arraignment, to discuss at that point their arrest and the charges against them. When we talk about alternatives, we are talking about programs that are usually run by a nonprofit organization or a healthcare facility, and those alternatives support an individual waiting for their arraignment, but do so either at, you know, their own space or at home, and are used to be able to have the supports that they need while they resolve their case.
So tell listeners a little bit about the Pretrial Justice Institute and how the documentary Time, the Khalif Browder Story is being used to help people understand what's at stake when someone is detained before trial.
Absolutely. So the Pretrial Justice Institute is actually almost 50 years old, and initially it was established as the only organization that was focused on the pretrial process. The intention has always been for this organization to help different stakeholders within the criminal legal system move towards like more efficiency and thinking about justice practices to reduce jail time or eliminate jail time. And that was because there was an observation that the system was saturated, you know, with court hearings. There's also overcrowding in jails, backlog courts, just many problems. So as we've grown over time, we learned, you know, that we needed other folks and other experts in the conversation. And so our work expanded to include advocacy, legislative advocacy, and really working with other partners to influence public policy, as well as conducting research. And so our work really elevates not just the academic version of what should be happening, right, through research, but actually also works in partnership with a local jurisdiction, whether that be a court system or folks who are impacted by the system. And that helps us shift narrative. So we can actually talk about and elevate the impact of programs and practices that have been shifted. We can also elevate how it impacts folks' lives when they are incarcerated. So to the story of Khalif Browder, Khalif is a young person, ends up, you know, having interaction with law enforcement in his neighborhood, a low-level offense, what we call, right, ends up having to go to Rikers and await his trial. Rikers Island is far away from many communities. It is, you know, off the side of New York City. And so for families to visit, there are a lot of limitations, not just the transportation, you know, there's long lines. Many times folks are not able to see their loved one the day that they arrive. It interrupts a lot of things in their lives. And so for Khalif Browder, it meant that he didn't have access to family supports that he could have had at home. He felt isolated. And within the jail facility, because the conditions are overcrowding, folks who both work in the jail facility and those who are arrested are really experiencing a lot of trauma in the space. It's not conducive of any rehabilitative effect. And so there's a lot of violence that happens. Unfortunately, that's one of the things that he experienced while there. There was a lot of violence, getting beat up, and again, not having access to support, whether that be medical support or family. And he spent, you know, a year in that space awaiting court. That's how long the court system is backed up. Many other factors also play into that. Sometimes the court date is set, the person is brought to court, but maybe the other attorney is not present, and so they have to reschedule. And in his case, that happened several times when somebody, you know, either the defense or the prosecutor's office are not ready with testimony or any evidence, the case gets postponed. And so that happened several times and was just why he spent so much time. And it's actually more common than we think for the rest of the folks that are in these jail facilities. So the violence he was experiencing, what he was witnessing, the lack of connection to his family led to a lot of trauma. And when he returned home, an inability to reintegrate. And isolation continued in that space at this point, unable to speak and just really verbalize what was happening. He, you know, really suffered mental health crisis that led to his death. And that was really hard for the family who continued to advocate.
Just to be clear for listeners who may not know, he hanged himself at his parents' home. Gisela, how common in New York City is pretrial detention in the overall general population?
Yes, it is. It has been increasing over years. Pre-pandemic, a lot of folks refer to that, you know, it was about 75% of the folks being held at Rikers that were just awaiting, had not been convicted, and just were awaiting their arraignment. At this point, we are closer to 85%, and that is not just alarming that it has increased, but it is a huge percentage that we want to address.
Gisela, in your report, A City Without Cages, it says that, quote, the pretrial process shows how racism drives dysfunction and harm across the criminal legal system, unquote. Can you explain what you mean by that and where bias tends to creep in? Is it at arraignment, when bail is set, or in any other time?
We actually use the phrase, no pretrial justice without racial justice. And the reason why is because we cannot do our work and feel successful without addressing the root causes that lead and feed into criminalization and essentially the criminal legal system and, you know, kickstarting with that pretrial process. What we notice is that certain behaviors more and more get criminalized and then become a reason to be arrested and detained rather than investing in community and being able to meet the needs of the communities that live within certain neighborhoods. If we see the numbers, there's always, wherever you are, major cities or any other area, that the discrepancy of folks of color that are incarcerated, detained, are always higher than their white counterparts. And so we have to address, you know, why certain behaviors are criminalized. I've also worked, you know, with women. And so there are also gender-based, you know, things that are criminalized. The child welfare system feeds into the criminal legal system. We see domestic violence also affect, and at times that's the first encounter into the criminal legal system. And those situations could be repaired and addressed with community interventions versus incarceration and arrest and being able to really dig into a story versus criminalizing the two people that are involved.
How does the inability to post bail effectively become a de facto detention for economically disadvantaged defendants?
Yeah, so if you can afford bail or have access to networks of support that can, you know, meet that bail amount, you are free to go, be home, be close to your loved ones as you await arraignment. And for folks who are struggling in poverty, and many times, again, are communities of color, that is not something they have access to. Their families are, they also experience interruptions of many things, whether that's childcare or jobs or housing stability. And so those who have the means, right, even if they are detained, the impact of their detainment doesn't have the level of consequences that it does on someone who's low income and unable to afford getting out.
Now, I understand that New York City detains a higher percentage of people pre-trial than many other large jurisdictions, even though overall crime and arrest rates have declined. Some jurisdictions, I gather, like Washington, D.C. or New Jersey, have dramatically reduced pre-trial detention. How have they done that?
Essentially, what is important about those jurisdictions is that there was a shift from bail being the default, and the system now considers other factors. So it allowed for a different perspective to be considered once, you know, you switch to thinking about this person as an individual and the needs that they have. Then there's consideration for other partners like community interventions and alternatives. These jurisdictions have utilized a number of other tools. Some of them are called like risk assessments, and those are tests that sort of evaluate the level of danger someone meets, you know, to either go home or have to be detained. What has happened in these jurisdictions is also that it allows for faster hearings, right? It just makes the court system a little more efficient in saying, okay, we're going to trust that this person's going to return to court and move away from detention as the first thing that we do. And what research has shown over time is that people do want to resolve their case and do return to court when these conditions are set up as a, you know, proof of trust, which is able to have like continuous effects on community. If you trust the court system, then you're more willing to cooperate and also more willing to think about your actions differently and, you know, really move away from some of the behaviors that might be impacting you in a negative way.
Let's look beyond the financial cost. What are the social, economic, and psychological effects on individuals who were detained pre-trial? You've mentioned, you know, jobs and families, but is there more, such as coercion to take a plea deal?
Absolutely. We can start there. People who want to be home or need to be home for any reason, whether that's childcare or being just a provider for their family, will most likely take the advice to take a plea deal. And then that becomes a part of their record. And if another instance of engagement with the criminal legal system happens, then that's already on their record. And it just amplifies, you know, this idea that this person continuously offends. And it's something that they can't really get out of, right? So I think part of the thing that people don't usually understand is how just one instance of an interaction that leads to an arrest and then the pretrial process and detention is like a mark forever for this person. On a social side, right, it's, again, the disturbance to interruptions to their family units, they end up just feeling isolated, right? Not able to come back and reintegrate with just one interaction. There's a lot of limitations that end up also being impacted in securing work or education. There's been a lot of advocacy that had to be done to remove the question whether you've been convicted of a crime, whether what that was low level or more, right? It was treated the same.
If you're just joining us, this is Heidi Boghossian, along with my co-host, Stephen Rohde. We're speaking with Gisela Marroquin from the Pretrial Justice Institute in New York.
Your research shows that being detained before trial can actually influence what happens at trial. How does pretrial detention affect case outcomes, conviction rates, and sentencing?
So one of the things that happens at times, and even when someone is detained and has to go to court, is that there are still limitations of transportation. They have to depend on court system or corrections department to establish, you know, when they leave a certain place. In New York City, there's a lot of traffic, and many times that has led to someone missing a court date, and it's not communicated up to the judge that this person was stuck in traffic. Other alternatives, if there are use like ankle monitoring, or, you know, that's still, you know, a form of surveillance. This person missing a court date, they got sick, someone else got sick. But these things are not given any consideration or communicated to a level that the judge can have as a basis of analysis when judging this person's, you know, outcome for their case. It begins to pile up as a file of notes and assumptions many times that are made about a certain person. Anything from, you know, if bail is set, right, then that person that goes on the record, and that's a consideration for the next person that looks at that file. And then it's at the discretion and their own interpretation of how they view this person. Other factors that happen if a person does miss a court date, instead of being considered as like they had a reason and, you know, let's write it down and inquire about it, it becomes something that is punished. And then that is why many times some folks are denied bail, or if in the past they've been arrested and maybe missed a court date, it continuously just appears there and makes this person seem like they are at like a high risk. So it does influence, you know, what happens at any other point in an interaction with law enforcement. It omits the presumption of innocence, right? We should be able to have the opportunity to prove our innocence, right? And that, just by jailing someone, you know, putting them in a cage, eliminates the ability for them to exercise that right. And when we think about, and we hear, you know, terrible stories about somebody who's been wrongfully accused of something, and most of the errors happen in that pretrial process, whether that's they didn't have access to their lawyer and they, you know, were interrogated in a certain way. And it just piles up, and you can see that at that pretrial end, this person either had their rights violated or wasn't able or didn't know what their rights were at that moment.
I'm curious, what about using electronic monitoring instead of pretrial detention? Are there problems with that?
Yes, the main problem is that it just creates another system of surveillance. People can also encounter limitations to having to stay within their home, right? If they have a child to pick up, if there is an emergency, if they have to respond to something and it's outside of the geographical limits that they have, then, you know, again, it gets marked as something that gets to be punished rather than acknowledged as something that is valid in their life. Most advocates really lean on saying that's not something that we should, you know, use as an alternative. And additionally, there are also like court fees and fees just in the use of them that are many times the person who needs to use it is the one responsible to pay for those things. So it adds another financial burden to this individual.
In our remaining minutes, tell us what needs to change in the landscape here of pretrial detention.
Our report, you know, is called A City Without Cages, because that's our long-term vision. And in order to make that possible, policy changes, any new policies, need to be informed by those who have a lived experience of having been through the criminal legal system. That was a major part of how the initial bail reform law was written. And since then, and all of the rollbacks that have happened, there has been a minimizing of those parts in the law, just leaning in again on the use of detention and judicial discretion, which has proven not to be effective. So what we need is new policies that also amplify the need and the importance of alternatives, of community solutions, instead of punitive practices, right? Criminalization of more and more community members. We definitely need the default to be, we want the safety and the support of community members versus the punishing of community members. As stated in our report, alternatives should be like the first line strategy. and they should be well-funded, right? We acknowledge that some increases have been made over the years, but the amount is definitely not comparable to what law enforcement, corrections, and any regulating agency has been allotted. You know, the ratio of how much is spent on someone who is on Rikers to how much an alternative program can cost is just a huge difference. And on the funding part, we continue to also think about funding across the ecosystem. We are all needed, and the report shows how we wanted to create a space with different perspectives and expertise that work within the pretrial space and for all of us to see each other and to work together. But we all need the funding equally to be able to show up and be an active member of this collective action. So in order to show that impact, we need long-term investment as well as investment across all of our fields and areas of expertise. So it's quite a lot to do, but I think it's possible with a lot of different collaborations.
Well said. How can our listeners follow you and the work of the Pretrial Justice Institute?
Well, we welcome anyone to visit our website. This report, along with other research that we've done, can be found on our website, so pretrial.org. We also have a help desk, which is just essentially a system where you can ask questions. Our staff, our board, and other experts that are in our circle answer those questions, are able to provide, you know, research to anybody who wants to look further into these issues. And we also post partner collaborations there as well, so you can see how an ecosystem is at work in trying to really deal with these issues at the pretrial end.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been really eye-opening, and we applaud the work that you and your colleagues are doing.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
RCT Pittsburgh. Welcome to our little experiment in freeform radio.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Lenorm with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. While coronavirus infections could go down over the next few months, we're still headed into flu season. Millions of Americans will be affected by the flu. But the good news is that we do have a safe and effective vaccine. But sadly, too many people go unvaccinated, especially African Americans. For more about flu vaccine, talk to your doctor or visit aawellnessproject.org.
Kissed at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go, riding along in my
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for people on the go.
I sent you to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere, and she leaned and whispered in my ear.
before we get started, I'd like to remind you that